So we're now entering the time for questions. And I thought to lead off, maybe we could have some comments on is there going to be a big change when we celebrate the centennial of Lethbridge, and can we build on all those things that you're teaching and actually do some planning into the future beyond the three-year budget period?
I'll just repeat what I was asked yesterday to say. I was at the Sweet Adeline supper for Christmas, and they really, really want a concert hall. So maybe that will be the way to go. Once the museum's built, though, since, you know, we'll get finished first. So I think what it's going to be is we're going to have to be a cultural mecca, because we're going to have all these great things, and everybody's going to visit Lethbridge looking for great culture. And that's where I'm going to stay on that.
Okay. Give your name first.
Got to have a mic first. Terry Shillington, thank you for your rapid-fire, high-energy presentation. I wonder if it's permissible to ask a question about the... I'd like to hear you tell some stories. We're in the middle of an election, and I found myself wondering, as you were talking about some of these stories, about the politics of early Lethbridge and whether, you know, from Winnipeg, for example, we know that... That workers became quite militant at some points, and there was quite a left-wing thrust. And I'm wondering about the coal workers and what the politics of early Lethbridge was. Has this always been a conservative community, or was there ever a kind of a left-wing bent among some of the coal workers? And go on.
We're not as left-wing as Protest House was back then, but we did have some. I love silly jokes to explain things. You know what a Westsider is, right? A Westsider is simply a Northsider trying very hard to be a Southsider. Sorry. But I guess that's probably the best way to explain it is we always had that North-South split, and so while the South side has always been the very conservative business owners, the North side has always had a little bit more of the worker feel to it. But we've had the 1906 strike and things like that, but we've not had the communist influence that other places such as Drumheller and the Crow's Nest Pass have felt. It's been to a lesser extent, those sorts of things. But it's been there, but more underground. I think it's because we had such a, we started such a company town with such a company feeling, and also we have very smart people who started it. The Gulfs figured a lot of ways out. They took care of their own workers. They built the hospital. They had all that sort of stuff in place for them. And while, you know, they weren't taken care of perfectly, they did have a little bit better way in some respects than others, in my opinion. That's my interpretation of history.
Ruth Alzinga, I have a question relative to archival, well, maybe it's not archival information, but when people have some things that they want to give to the museum, what's the process? And right now, during construction, your museum is closed, isn't it?
So
it's not open till January. But when one does have something in their possession that they feel that the museum would have enjoy having it or appreciate having it, how does one go about giving it away?
We love donations. It depends on what kind of donation. If it's documentary or what we consider the written material, it goes to the archives, and you can speak to the archivist, Greg Ellis. If it's a three-dimensional, an artifact, or anything like that, it goes to the collections department, and you would talk to Kevin McLean, the collections technician. But we do have a moratorium on donating until we're back in the open. Our entire collections are three-dimensional in boxes right now. But it goes through a process. You meet with that person. They get a whole bunch of information on you, the provenance of the artifact. And then it goes through a committee. We actually have an acquisitions committee who decides whether it meets the criteria to be accepted. There's a group of community members who sit with our staff, go through everything that's being donated, and decide whether we have space for it, the condition of it, the history of it, if it meets all those criteria. And then it's accepted or not. I love speaking for Kevin. You have to understand our relationship.
Howard Forsyth. I noticed you said at one point something about the communities around Lethbridge. And since my hometown is McGrath, and I also lived for a while in Raymond and Hill Spring and Cardston, I'm wondering how much responsibility you take for the communities. For example, does your charter specify that it's just Lethbridge, or does it say Lethbridge? I know McLeod does things and Pinscher does things, and I guess Colville does, but how much territory do you feel you adequately represent for historical purposes?
We actually have a geographical area that we collect from. It's to Bow Island, to Nanton, to the BC border, to the United States. But we also have a responsibility when we get in an artifact or in an archival document, if it is better suited to be donated to another museum, we will recommend that they take it there. But if it has a regional interest or electric interest, we will accept it. So it is that we have sent things to other museums recommending that they donate it there. We are just one museum out of many in Southern Alberta, and we do a lot of partnerships and work with the other museums and respect them so that we don't want to do poaching. Nothing worse than a museum industry, and some museums have the reputation of being a poacher. The worst thing you can become. No, we don't do that.
Tad Mitsui. You said something very interesting as an educator in the beginning. I don't remember exact wording you used, but all histories are biased. Well, could you tell me how you worded it? My question is relating to that.
Right. It's interpretation. Just what you choose to tell, events you choose to do is all biased. Sometimes we're aware of our bias and we can try to minimize it, but no matter how much we minimize it, it will be there. And other people aren't even aware of their bias, like some people. And so, I mean, we've all gone to places where whatever the curator likes is the only thing ever exhibited. That's a definite bias. But even when you try to minimize it, there's certain interests that we're always going to show up with. You're going to devote more of your time to it in that sort of respect. You cannot take bias out. That's why we try to involve the community as much as possible. So at least then we have 100 biases rather than just one.
That's excellent. So if you don't mind hearing my question coming out of that comment, you believe that it's the best education is for a learner to discover things by themselves, mm-hmm. especially the kids. That's where the trouble comes in. When children discover something that we don't want them to find out, or if we discover something that donors don't want us to find out, mm-hmm. that may affect your standing in the community or fundraising ability, etc., etc. How do you deal with that?
We're always having to deal with controversy. We have one staff member whose goal in life would be to do an exhibit on the red light district. We don't let him. He can write books on it and everything else, but we also have a responsibility to the community to listen, to tell the truth. No, we don't have that responsibility. I'm just kidding. We have a responsibility to look at their interests and do exhibits on things that will be of their interest. But honestly as well, we also have to be marketable. I mean, we cannot just have personal interest in the exhibits. They have to be something that will attract a large clientele. So there is a balancing act in museums that is always between that, you know, what you want to do, what you should do, and what you have to do. I'll just leave it at this. I'm a city employee, and I don't want to ever be fired either. Yeah. You have to be aware of that. And thank heavens I'm not in management, so I can be a little more controversial than the people who actually are responsible for making the decision.
Thank you for that.
Don't tell anybody I was honest. I'm just kidding.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for your, as one gentleman called it, rapid-fire presentation, which was excellent. I have been on, just for your own information, on City Council, where I've had some interest in history and museums, and we have had a checkered past on that. And I don't think the present building is going to change it very much, because that's built to be a museum piece. And when you build somebody something to be a museum piece, that's what it'll be. I can remember being on council when we were going to, everybody was building a museum, and every 10 miles they were going to have a museum. And I was just dumbfounded that this would happen. But anyway, they said one way to get it, and is anybody on council? Oh, Ruth is here. She may remember this. We had to make an application and show what we were doing. And this could not be somebody in the community just checking up and say, yeah, that's what you should do. We had to hire a government identified group of people that were so-called experts. We paid them $50,000, I think, and we never got anything out of it. Because I believe that we did the right thing. We said, no, we're not going to have a museum just like that. And that was it. So my question to you is, how do you find where the line is? If I go into a museum, I'm a museum piece already. I mean, I'm going to fit. I'm 82 years of age. And there isn't half the things that you see in an ordinary museum. You'll note that I have been old enough to see those. I remember the steam tractors. That was before the gasoline tractors, you know. And down in the steep place in Sterling where I lived with my family, we rented land there, that was there for years. And then I see Mr. Papworth here, he's interested in this kind of thing. But in the agricultural sector, which is our plum here, and that's what we got to do, we're finding that it's a little more difficult than you might think. But how do you decide when you can convince your public, who's got to pay the bill for it, that it's worth doing because it hasn't been around long enough, or it hasn't got an interest stirred up enough to support it? That's what we've always had to decide. When do we go from taking the kids out of a classroom because you've got to go to a museum, or say it's a museum, people can come and go as they want?
Well, I think that goes back to what I said at the beginning, is that everybody has a different desire for a museum and what they want from the museum, and we have to be 10,000 things to 10,000 people. And I think we balance all of that pretty well. But this sounds like a silly answer, but it's all about policy. If you can make a policy that says we're collecting things for these purposes, you can collect something you find today, because collecting is about, we know it'll disappear. So we can collect things that existed today. And it's also important to collect things that we think will become important. Things that today we might all go, groan, why are you collecting it? But it's ephemeral and it's not going to be around. So thank heavens it's more of Kevin's and Greg's problem to worry about. I just get to play with everything. But they really do consider that all the time, and I don't think I can give as clear of answer as they would. But it is something that's certainly talked about around our staff table.
My name is Henry Heinen, and I just wonder, do you guys also are looking out at getting into wax statues?
As far as I know, no.
Because I think John might qualify to be the first exhibit. Now, secondly, I think Pastor Shillington wanted you to tell some stories, and being a man of the cloth, he may not have wanted to elucidate that further, but I had in my mind...
You want real stories?
That he wanted to tell us, that you were going to tell us a story about the common body houses that were very prominent in Lethbridge. There's a whole book about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm interested in, at our age, looking at this crowd, I think we can handle the subject. But what was the reason why there was such an, you know, illegal, thriving business when it came to the red light district, and why did it dissipate or go away if it did?
You actually said the appropriate word. It's business. They did close it down on New Year's Eve in 1912. A week later, the businessmen were complaining so much about loss of money, they let it reopen again. So it really was a big part of the economy. I mean, everybody turned a blind eye to it, but I'm sure there were a few people getting rich off it as well, and that certainly would have kept it. Why it closed down is actually quite funny. It closed down in World War II officially, not because of moral reasons, but because of health reasons. Too many venereal diseases was affecting the World War II war effort, so they closed it down. So even though they fought it morally for a long time, it closed because of health. But one of the things, it was very well run in Lethbridge. Like, it had a certain area, and it stayed in that area. The police, you know, turned a blind eye to it. And if you want a funny story, we were reading along, and you come across quotes that kind of stick in your mind. Laudanum was the drug of choice for prostitutes who wanted to commit suicide in Lethbridge. I'm not sure who did a study on that or how they ever found that out. So it wasn't as glamorous a job as you might think. We've also come across a book called Madeline, and this was, again, through partnership. It was actually the Sterling Museum who hooked us up with this. It is a first-person anonymous autobiography of a woman who worked as a prostitute and then a madam in southern Alberta at around the turn of the century. She will not identify the town, but if you ever read this book, and you have to actually download it from a university website in the United States, it is Lethbridge. It is hilarious because you have this very bold, outspoken Scottish minister and this really quiet Roman Catholic priest. And everything that you think about Lethbridge history is in there. And it has been one of the, you know, finds of the century for understanding their lifestyle. She became an alcoholic. She was a single mother, and it really gave a personalized story to us. But of course, we can't prove it's Lethbridge. But if you want, I can get you that book if you really want to enjoy the story.
About 3 years ago, we went to an opera at the Bout Springs, Bout Center, Philomena. And that is an interesting story of bootlegging in the Crow's Nest Pass. Now, I should be asking you, or I should probably be asking a librarian, but because it's so historical and the events that surrounded that, is there archival information on that, or have you done something on sort of, when we're talking about these vices, bootlegging in the Crow's Nest, etc.?
It's very much oral history. Like, we know of grain trucks that headed to the States with a whole bunch of alcohol in the bottom. So a lot of it is, you know what the best story is? Get a group of people like this talking, sit in the corner and write everything down. So we got a lot of great oral history on that, and we, in many cases, we even have names, but we don't have any evidence that, you know, that you'd want to write down, because when you do community history, you're doing family history, and some families probably wouldn't want you to be doing their family history. So you come and talk to me, and I'll tell you all the gossip, but I won't say it on TV.
Belinda, if you were to select one symbol to represent the essence of being a Lethbridgian, as opposed to a Taborite or some other community, what would that central symbol be? I mean, you've just ruled out the red light district. What other phenomena have happened in 100 years that would give us an identity that we could carry with us into the future?
Well, that's not putting me on the spot at all, is it? You know, it's almost January, so if I had to explain Lethbridge, it'd be with the god Janus, the Roman god, because everybody thinks we're one way, but we're always actually looking the other way. There's a mythologized, you know what I mean, history of Lethbridge that we buy into and we teach the kids, and then there's the real history. So I think that would be what I would describe Lethbridge as. I've got so many stories, I can never think of them when I actually need to. But we have stories about, nobody here works with police, do they? Our entire police force has primarily been fired twice. because of their role in corruption or their assumed role in corruption. Pre-charter police force, please don't think they're today's police force. But, you know, we always think of the West as law and order, and we weren't that law and order West. We were a little wilder than most, and I'm very proud to have been from a place that's a little wilder than most, because you have to understand Lethbridge. You can't just glance over Lethbridge. You got to do some digging, and it makes it a lot more fun to do. I bet you all have skeletons if I kept digging.
This is Pastor Shillington reporting in with a second question here. unlike the Baptists, I'm not so concerned about vices, but I want to go back to your conversation with Pat Matsui at the beginning about history written with a bias, which is of course true. It's true of the Bible, and it's true every time we write history. The remark has been made that history is written by winners. And so we named the museum after Galt, and I don't know who Stafford was, but I presume he wasn't one of the losers, or she.
At his end he was.
Pardon? At the end?
He kind of got forgotten towards the end of his life.
Well, I wonder how well the museum tells the story of the losers and the minorities. And I guess that would include First Nations people and the story of the Japanese who came in the Second World War and coal miners, and I'm not sure who you'd classify as the losers, but they would not be the business community anyway, and the corporate elite.
Right. There is an inherent difficulty in that, is that you don't have as much information, because of course there's not as much written information. But I'll give you an anecdote that sticks with me. We had the Nikkei Tapestry exhibit. So we had an exhibit on Japanese Canadians going right from the earliest Japanese Canadian immigrants here, about 1900 through. And we had visitors who went right through the entire exhibit and came out and they said, "Where's the real museum?" Excuse me? And they said this to our volunteer who just happened to be Japanese Canadian. "Where's the real museum? Where's the pioneer history?" And this was a woman whose family moved here in 1903. Family's been here 100 years, and she was not considered pioneer history because, of course, she wasn't European with a white background. So we tried very hard to bring those stories out. But it's also, I like to brag about history, but you also have to talk about the bad things, like Christmas Day riot, which I'm shocked to say most people aren't aware of, when we basically destroyed Chinatown. There was a gentleman, I love how the paper used to write things. He had visited several restaurants prior. He was drunk. Of course, they didn't say that, but that would be likely the case. Went into a Chinese restaurant, got into a fight with the waiter, who, for whatever reason, hit him over the head with a hammer. The rumor got around town that he had been killed, so 500 angry people descended on Chinatown looking for the waiter, destroyed the restaurant, and was turning their eyes on the other parts of Chinatown when Mayor Galbraith had to arrive with the Northwest Mounted Police, and the only time the Riot Act has ever been called in Lethbridge. So we do have those stories. But you're right, we haven't done enough of them. It's very easy to tell the mainstream history, but it's doing a disservice to everybody else who was part of it. And that really is where programming gets to come in, because we may not have enough in every case to do an exhibit on it, but we can certainly flesh out the story so that you understand that it isn't just the traditional story. There's a lot more going on than people are aware. And I'm not a big fan of the new social studies curriculum, but the one thing they're really doing from young on is trying to get those other stories out there. And so hopefully we can extend that right through the adults. Like I said, you just come and talk to us. We can give you all kinds of things. And the other thing, if you're really bored, read the index for the Lethbridge Herald between 1901 and 1918. It's really fascinating reading. I read it all the time, but I'm kind of worried.
If I may speak from the museum, can I ask you, ma'am, I presume you are aware of the book Charcoal.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that is just a priceless artifact that you'd have for this area. Now, is there anything that you do, or do you think it's worth trying to
use a little more salesmanship or something to get that book read. Because I think that tells a history just prior to civilization, you might say. Well, they got the guy and they shot him. If you he hung mm-hmm. because he killed a policeman. And that's not too far from what they did in, where was it the other day? In California, when they executed the guy. So I'm just saying, is it worthwhile to do something special to get charcoal out there to be read by people in school?
The only school who I know it's on the curriculum is Red Crow Community College. It's part of their curriculum, and that's sad, because that's the only ones reading it are the ones who already know the story. And yeah, it should be in all the schools. I found it fascinating. When we did the Ancestors exhibit, we had Blackfoot tour guides and programmers, and their approach to teaching was so completely different from mine. I've always been taught, teach boys and girls exactly the same. You cannot, you know, treat them differently. Where our Blackfoot programmers would walk into an exhibit, take all the girls and show them some things and tell them certain things, then tell the girls to go off on their own, would take the boys and show them something completely different. Because that was culturally how they were taught. And so it would be very, very nice to be able to have, you know, I would love to have a Chinese person, a Japanese person, a Blackfoot person, and every other group on the staff at the Gulf, because not only would our staff learn a lot, I think the public would learn a lot more. And so, yes, I encourage very much to read those sorts of things, but I'm not sure how we can convince the Alberta Education Department to put that one on the curriculum. I will be promoting it to more teachers. If you're right, it's an amazing book.
My name is Sylvia Campbell, and I probably am showing my own ignorance, but I'm really curious about the tunnels that are under Lethbridge, and I unfortunately was too busy to go on one of the tours. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there were the old coal mine tunnels, and they've since, of course, been closed, but there have been other tunnels. Our tunnel has a myth to it and a reality to it, and I won't tell you which is which, but it was a tunnel that came off the morgue and used to be there. It also attached to a...